Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor for a conversation between Josh Silver, founder and director of Represent Us, a postpartisan organization that passes laws that fix our broken elections, and Will Thorndike, founder and managing director at Housatonic Partners, a leading middle market private equity firm. The title of today's talk is Unbreaking America. This talk is one of many from the 2020 College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute, whose theme was November 3rd, What's at Stake? It was originally presented online on July 31st, 2020. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. It will be archived on our website, mainpublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing the conversation today is Ted Widmer, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs.
Good morning. Today marks the last day of July, and it also marks the last day of the 2020 Champlain Institute. And we're about to start a session with Will Thorndike and Josh Silver called Unbreaking America. But I just want to thank everyone involved with the Champlain Institute for creating such an exhilarating week, a week that even in these dark times felt inspiring. It's always hard to organize an ideas festival on this scale. This year, obviously, it was more so, but it came off beautifully. And I want to thank Lynn Bolger, who does so much to make it happen, Darren Collins, and my host for the week, Will Thorndike. The Institute began on Monday with a conversation I had with Hillary Rodham Clinton. And in that conversation, she quoted John Lewis beautifully, quote, he had said in her hearing, "Do not give in, do not give up, do not give out." And then she added, "Because he did not give up on us." And the Champlain Institute did not give up on us either. Not giving up is a pretty good theme because so much is at stake this year on November 3rd, and that is the theme of our Champlain Institute. Yesterday, President Trump floated the idea of a delay in the election, a delay he has no power to authorize, and encouragingly, leaders of both parties, Republican Party also, finally said no in the spirit of Margaret Chase Smith, the great Republican senator from Spain whom Hillary Clinton talked about on Monday. And in this morning's Washington Post, there's a powerful op-ed by Michael Waldman, an old friend of mine, about how violent a disruption of our history it would be to change an election date. Even in the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln underwent an election. It turned out to be a re-election, although he wasn't sure. And so it is incumbent on all of us to save this election on November 3rd, which might turn out to be synonymous with saving America. I want to introduce our two speakers who will tell us a lot about what's at stake, but I want to close my introductory remarks with the final paragraph of John Lewis's very powerful op-ed yesterday, which is really addressed to young people, including all of the undergraduates from COA who I hope are watching. "When historians pick up their pens to write the story of the 21st century, let them say that it was your generation who laid down the heavy burden of hate at last, and that peace finally triumphed over violence, aggression, and war. So I say to you, walk with the wind, brothers and sisters, and let the spirit of peace and the power of everlasting love be your guide." And with that inspirational message, it's my pleasure to introduce Will and Josh. Will is well known to everyone on this campus, and in fact, he helped to come up with the idea of the Champlain Institute a few years ago. He founded Housatonic Partners in Boston in 1994, a leading middle market private equity firm with offices in Boston and San Francisco. He's been managing director since that time. He's a graduate of Harvard College, which is where I met him many years ago, and Stanford Graduate School of Business. He serves on the boards of many nonprofits and WGBH in Boston, the public television and radio station, and here at the College of the Atlantic. And he's an author. He wrote a wonderful book, The Outsiders, Eight Unconventional CEOs and Their Radically Rational Blueprint for Success in 2012. He will be joined in conversation by Josh Silver. Josh is the founder and director of Represent Us, a postpartisan nonprofit organization advancing campaign finance and election reform across the nation. Represent Us has built one of the largest grassroots and social media communities in the democracy reform field, with a focus on how to leverage systemic change through mass movements that traverse diverse political ideologies. Josh publishes widely on democracy, media, election, campaign finance, and a range of other public policy issues. So please welcome Josh and Will.
Thanks, Ted, for that extremely generous and gracious introduction. It's wonderful to be on stage here at the Gates Auditorium at College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. And it's a great delight to be up here with Josh Silver, who I should mention at the outset is here despite a broken pelvis suffered in a mountain biking accident a couple of months ago, which is both impressive and kind of cool.
And dumb, so, possibly.
And, well, and possibly yeah, that as well, yes. So we're going to head down into the engine room of our political system in this session. And I think the best framework for thinking about Josh's work at Represent Us is that regardless of your top political priorities, whether they're climate control or Black Lives Matter or healthcare policy or whatever, true reform is only possible if the machinery of our system is working. And if the gears are stuck, as they clearly are currently, real reform, real progress is virtually impossible. So I think it's useful to think of Josh and his organization as talented, nimble mechanics working to add much needed grease to a very rusty political gearbox. So a word on format. Josh is going to start providing us with a little background, a little context via a couple of video clips. And he and I will then head into conversation. We'll allow plenty of time for Q&A at the end, and we encourage everyone to submit questions along the way. And Josh, over to you.
Thanks, Will. And thanks, College of the Atlantic and Champlain Institute, for having me. I'm excited. You know, it's bittersweet having the pandemic. We can't have a crowd here, but on the upside, this will probably be the first time in my career I won't be booed, which is great. So I'm just looking for the positive. We're going to go to the screen here. We have a visual presentation for about 10 minutes. And the reason is I'm going to throw a lot at you in a short amount of time, and the visuals will help. And we're here. I dare say I was invited because we're all concerned. We're deeply concerned with the state of American politics. Most recently, we've got unmarked federal agents, troops in the streets. There's increasing signs of distrust. We had disruption. A soft civil war has emerged over the last few years that is unlike anything I certainly have seen in my 52 years, and unlike anything really we've seen in generations in this country. Of course, we're suffering from this pandemic that grips the world, but we have this daunting and embarrassing truism that we have the most coronavirus cases in the world and the most deaths in the world. And in comparison to other countries, it's pretty horrific. I mean, we're looking here against Australia, Europe, Canada, Japan, and you can see that red line's the US. This is not because the US has more people. This is actually new weekly coronavirus cases right now per million residents. So this is relative, and it shows the abject failure in our coronavirus response. But the fact is that this coronavirus response failure is just yet the latest of the government failures that are recurring over and over again, be it education, poverty, addressing gun safety, climate, you name it. And we all sit here casting, sort of scratching our heads and wondering, what's the problem? Who's to blame? Many people blame President Trump. Many people blame Speaker Pelosi. We see a level of vitriol and partisanship that is unprecedented, once again, perhaps really since the 1800s. But the fact is there's an elephant in the room, and Will alluded to it here at the outset. And that elephant is this system failure that grips American politics. We're going to unpack it, and I'm going to get a little help here from the actor Michael Douglas. Let's roll.
America's political system has been hijacked to ensure those with power keep it. And for the rest of us, Well, it's not so good.
This Venn diagram shows the relationship between an elected official doing what the people want and their likelihood of getting reelected. The relationship looks more like this. They found virtually no correlation between serving the will of the people and getting reelected. In other words, if our elected leaders do their jobs, they're more likely to lose their jobs. The report blames it on two privately held gain-seeking organizations, America's two major political parties. In 2019, both major parties publicly threatened to blacklist candidates and contractors who veered from the party lines. They control the money, the debates, the primaries. They even draw their own voting districts. So year after year, we choose between the lesser of two evils, Democrats, Republicans, Republicans, Democrats. In any other environment, a new competitor would swoop in to better serve their constituency. You hate your cable company? Here comes streaming. But the two parties have rigged the system to block competition. Hardliners are rewarded. Collaboration is vilified. Congress is so gridlocked they can't even pass the most basic laws to improve the lives of everyday Americans. For the first time since the Great Depression, life expectancy in the U.S. is actually going down while it goes up in the rest of the world. We were once ranked top in the world for education. We've fallen to 27th. We can't afford life-saving prescriptions, and medical bills are forcing families into bankruptcy. Almost half of American families can't even afford basic necessities like rent and food. What I want to know is, how do we fix it?
And the answer is by fixing the system, because if we fix the system, we can fix everything else. I'm getting one more little help here for another 2-minute video from actress Jennifer Lawrence, who's on our board of directors, who takes on this question of how do we fix the system? Let's go to tape.
So the question is, how do we unrig this system? I'm obsessed with this idea, not just of unrigging it, but actually fixing it. That's when I met Josh.
This is it. This is the issue behind the issues. If we fix the system, we'll have so much more power to fix everything else. So I spoke to some of the most brilliant people in the country. Constitutional scholar Lawrence Lessig, Zephyr Teachout, and dozens of other constitutional scholars and experts and strategists. They all said the same thing. You could pass a law that would stop political bribery and fix our broken elections. And if you could do that, you could wrest power away from the corrupt establishment and put it back in the hands of the people. We took all of these reforms and put them in a model law and named it the Anti-Corruption Act. And get this, 87% of Americans support making the Anti-Corruption Act the law of the land. But on this issue, more than any other issue, it's like asking the fox to put a lock on the hen house. So we need to go around Congress, in this case, by passing anti-corruption acts in cities and states all across America. How does passing city and state laws lead to fixing all of these problems with the federal government?
Can I do this part?
Go for it.
So first of all, the U.S. Constitution gives states sole control over how elections are run, even federal elections. So when we fix gerrymandering or election laws, that fixes a federal election in each state. That means that by going state by state, we have an immediate impact on how we elect Congress and how we hold them accountable. We're bringing conservatives and progressives together to pass anti-corruption laws all across America. Every voice matters. Your voice matters. If you do nothing, nothing changes. But if we all do a little, we can win together. So the only question left is this. Will you cross that line? Join us at represent.us.
Thanks, Jen. So there are two pieces in this video that we kind of scratched the surface on, and we have the luxury of a moment here so I can explain it a little better. And Will, before the presentation, was saying how taken he is by the following graph, and that is our history shows that when an issue is stuck in Washington, D.C., well, you can go to the states and you can pass it at the state level and it can lead to federal victory. So let's take a look at the slide here. Women's right to vote, women's suffrage, 1890 to 1920. We're looking at this arc of 30 years here where you win the right to vote in a few states in the West and more win And then you get to this yellow line, interracial marriage. This is 180 years. The Northeast, more states win. You get to this yellow line. Marriage equality from 2004 to 2016. We get it in Massachusetts, then a few more states. We get to the yellow line. And the conclusion from looking at this history, including marijuana and term limits and other policies, is that a key event, often a court decision or a grassroots campaign reaching maturity, triggers a rush of state activity that ultimately leads to a change in federal law. So simply put, what we are doing with democracy is replicating the success of those movements by passing these laws all across the country, but with an eye towards this Venn diagram, which is this idea that we have to go after policies that are impactful and are politically viable that can pass. Because too often, people like me sit on a stage like this with people like Will and say, we got to pass this policy, but the fact is the secret is it's actually impossible to ever see it pass. Or we should pass this policy that is doable, but it doesn't really change much. So it's finding that sweet spot in between is the key. And the key there is finding those policies that actually change incentives. And I'm going to unpack that a little bit, because we can't count on politicians to do things out of the good of their hearts. We have to create a system that incentivizes public interest outcomes. In short, the policies that sit in that Venn diagram today in 2020, are we? Time's flying. Ending gerrymandering, ranked choice voting and open primaries, automatic voter registration and vote by mail, campaign finance and ethics. That's a lot, so I'm going to unpack it here. Ending gerrymandering promotes competition and moderation and fixes these ridiculous maps of U.S. congressional districts that exist across the country. It is so bad that they literally made an alphabet out of congressional districts. These are not doctored people. This is real. 86% of U.S. House districts are gerrymandered. And what people do, and this is what we were getting at in the video, is that when all of the competition is in the primary election, because 86% of general elections are gerrymandered, and only a few people turn out for primary elections, and they are the most extreme voters, be it conservative on the right or the left, politicians are incentivized to create policy platforms that are directed towards the most extreme voters because of gerrymandering, ranked choice voting. This also promotes moderation and competition, but in a different way. Michael Douglas talked about the two-party duopoly. Ranked choice voting is what can break it, because by ranking your candidates as they do in Maine, no other states, then you actually can create a system where, let's say, Justin Amash or any other candidate, I put him here because he was thinking about running as a libertarian and didn't, because he would be a spoiler. And by being a spoiler, meaning by voting for Justin Amash, you would actually likely help the candidate that you dislike the most. You end the spoiler effect, and you also create a system that is more attuned to a country in which between 38 and 46% of voters are independents. It was 46% 2 years ago. More voters kind of moved towards the parties over the last 2 years because of the polarization of the Trump administration. It will go back up. And then the third policy area is automatic voter registration and vote by mail, which promotes participation, voter IQ, and lower costs. I'm going to unpack this a little bit more, Will, because vote by mail is so front of mind for our audience right now with what Will was talking about, Ted was talking about at the beginning. It increases turnout. Voting by mail actually increases it by about 14% amongst registered voters nationwide. We know that because five states actually have 100% vote by mail systems across the country: Colorado, Hawaii, Washington, Oregon, Utah, and California. California is the sixth because they've effectively they were moving towards it and fast-tracked it with COVID. And if you look at the results from the primary elections this year in 2020, you see that three of the top five turnout states this year were states with full vote by mail: Colorado, Oregon, and Washington. It costs about 40% less than traditional elections. It has an infinitesimal rate of fraud, despite what the president and his proxies allege, and it doesn't unfairly benefit one party over the other. There is peer-reviewed reams of data from esteemed institutions like Stanford and elsewhere that prove it. And then one of the things I like the best about vote by mail is that it increases voter IQ. I mean, it's a totally different experience. Here you are, you're at home, you've got your computer, you've got your little poll, your information booklet on candidates, and you've got time. And who here has not been in a polling booth and looked down ballot? You don't know who anybody is. You don't have time. You don't have Google, you know, and so it's just a superior system. Finally, it's campaign finance reform. This one is barely in the viable section, but it's so important to restoring integrity and addressing the dependence corruption that politicians have on their donors. Campaign spending is just out of control. This is blue is congressional elections. Beige is presidential. We've seen it effectively double from 2000 to 2018 in the cost of elections. It's pushing $7 billion. And keep in mind, in 2000, the costs were already running away. So those are the policies. They sit at the intersection of impact and viability. And here's the good news. The good news is, and I dare say the reason I was invited, is that we're part of this effort that is seeing victories. We've seen over 120 state and local democracy reform victories, whether through ballot initiatives, winning laws passed through state legislatures, county commissions, all across the country since 2012. We saw 23 major state and large city victories in 2018, the most ever recorded for this issue in the history of our country. 2019, we saw 19 victories. In 2020, we have many campaigns underway, but then of course, this happened. The pandemic strikes and we suddenly see the 2020 election under threat. We start to see pictures like this coming. This was Wisconsin, April 7th, but we've seen it from states across the country. This feeling that we can't vote safely, that we're facing a voting crisis. And the solution to it, as most of your well-informed visitors and viewers know, is voting by mail and ensuring safe polling stations. Fortunately, there are dozens of organizations in this country that have jumped into the fray since March 2020. They are lobbying states. They are lobbying Congress for more money. They are mounting really effective legal defense and offense. Ted alluded to Michael Waldman with Brennan Center at NYU. Incredible work there and elsewhere. And they're educating the public on how to vote by mail. Mostly partisans and their proxies on both sides doing that, but they're doing it. The reason that our organization was founded is to do a gap analysis, to figure out what's missing and to fill it. And that's what we're doing. That's our role. And I'm going to go through these four gaps. And it's not to toot our own horn, but it's to give viewers a sense of what's going on and how do we make sure that our democracy gets back on track, big picture, over the next few years. And then we'll go to Q&A. Number one gap is air cover this year to make sure that voters can vote safe. As Ted said, this is the tweet from yesterday from President Donald Trump, in which he actually says the vote by mail is so fraudulent that we may have to delay the election. And when you have this kind of rhetoric, which has been going on for a long time, you need a counterpunch. And counterpunch is in the form of this campaign we launched 2.5 months ago called Vote Safe, led by a Republican former governor and first Homeland Secretary Tom Ridge, which is essentially making sure that it is credible conservatives pushing back against bogus allegations of vote by mail being fraudulent and advantaging one party over the other, rather than Democrats, rather than letting it fall into this nonsense left versus right, Democrat versus Republican debate. And the coverage has been astounding. We've seen wall-to-wall coverage across the board of our conservative spokespeople quoted in more than half of the articles on the topic in the major news outlets in a period of about 6 weeks. We've also created vote safe campaigns in some really high competition states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And that's gap number one. Gap number two is winning the major 2020 ballot initiatives, mostly ballot initiatives, that are to advance the policies that I described a few minutes ago. So if you look at the yellow, that's the anti-gerrymandering campaigns happening in states across the country. You can add Oregon. It just got back on the ballot thanks to a court case last week. Ranked choice voting are purple. Open primaries, which makes sure that everybody can vote in the primaries and we're not segmented by party. That's the maroon color or the orange color. Money in politics is green, and vote by mail and automatic voter registration are blue. That's gap number three. Our team is making sure that those win on November 3rd. While everyone's paying attention to Trump versus Biden, you could argue that these ballot initiatives are even more important in some ways, certainly not all. Number three is winning vote by mail everywhere in 2021. There's this major opportunity brought by the pandemic crisis, and that is to pass 100% vote by mail in dozens of states all across America over the next year or two, while there's this dark cloud of COVID that still sits over the country. We've targeted these light purple. The dark purple are the states that already have it. These light purple states where we are setting up coalitions, communications campaigns, hiring lobbyists to win full vote by mail policies that are permanent in the 2021 legislative cycle. And finally, setting up major reforms for 2021 and beyond. I ran you through the map before. This is the map of states where we are pushing for both state legislative and ballot initiative campaigns to win sweeping reforms and continue this trend of real major democracy reforms happening across America. So as I close, I want to emphasize what's at stake here, because the government spends roughly $5 trillion a year, and every expenditure is affected by who is in office and what their incentives are. And the results of our government being so poor are the results of the skewed incentives brought by these wonky policies that I've just described. Everything hinges on fixing this problem. And if we do nothing, if we as a country continue to do little to nothing, which has been the history, people watching this video right now, odds are you have not been involved in this because you wasn't even registering on your radar. But the fact is we have to stop playing the short game at the expense of the long game. We can't only focus on the next election. You can't only focus on that next threat to climate change or to education or poverty. We can no longer ignore this issue. We have to also pay attention to it, fund it, and make sure it is successful. If we fail, this dark cloud that sits over our country will get darker still. The instability we're seeing in financial markets will grow. We will see more unrest in the streets. We will have more of an acute feeling like the world and the nation that we are passing to the next generation is not as good and sane and healthy as the one we were handed. So the good news is, if we do something, if we commit to fixing this problem of our democracy, we can make America that shining beacon on the hill that it was after World War II again.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features a conversation between Josh Silver, founder and director of Represent Us, a postpartisan organization that passes laws that fix our broken elections, and Will Thorndike, founder and managing director at Housatonic Partners, a leading middle market private equity firm. The title of today's talk is Unbreaking America.
Excellent, Josh. Thank you very much. That was a terrific summary and I think very helpful sort of grounding for everyone. So let me ask you, are these reforms really nonpartisan in nature? Or are there sort of inevitably winners and losers, at least in the short term?
They really are. They really are, Will. And I'll give you the best evidence of that. When our organization starts putting together campaigns and supporting campaigns in blue states that in which the Democrats enjoy an advantage in numbers in the legislature, the governor's mansion, secretary of state, AG, it is the Democratic Party that quietly undermines our work. When we are in red states, the Republicans do it. The Republicans are more overt in their opposition to us, but the opposition from the Democrats is real, and it's just more low key. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, both championed campaign finance reform and democracy reform when they were candidates for president during their first run. Both enjoyed Democratic majorities in the US Congress for the first 2 years of their administrations, and both sat on their hands when it came to this issue. So at the end of the day, when it comes to actually going beyond the rhetoric and taking action, the Democrats are almost as bad as the Republicans on the issue of actually expending political capital to make this happen.
Yeah. And so how do you ensure sort of a nonpartisan approach going forward?
Well, one thing is you keep saying it over and over again. Yeah. you keep doing things like Vote Safe and getting the right spokespeople out who are Republicans. But also, I think you remind the public that the two-party system is broken. And like, I'm not a Democrat. And I truly believe that we have to break the duopoly to fix this. And that's not rhetoric. That's not a liberal cabal dressing up as a nonpartisan thing. It's like, this is a fact, is that we have to introduce competition to our political system the same way that capitalism needs competition. And both parties are going to resist it because it's an existential threat to them. And that's why this has been so hard.
You described this sort of tipping point, you know, sand grain by sand grain, city by city, state by state approach. And it's an intentionally long game, you know. So do we have time for that? You know, is there a scenario where we can get Congress and the president to move more quickly?
So I'll let you think of it this way. Well, do you remember when I was showing you the slide of women's suffrage? Mm-hmm. We're talking about women's right to vote, which for us in 2020 is like kind of a no-brainer. I was showing you a slide between 1890 and 1920. Now, keep in mind, before that first state gave the women the right to vote, I think it was Wyoming, there was a lot of work done to get that to happen before that chart even started. Interracial marriage, I showed you a 180-year chart. We have to have existential humility. We have to be aware that some things take time, and especially the most important things. We may see a Democratic trifecta in the U.S. Congress this year. You might see a bunch of bold reforms passed because the Democrats do see that right now the Republicans, through gerrymandering particularly, game the system in to their advantage, and on campaign finance, that the Democrats might actually have more of an advantage by addressing campaign finance reform because the Republicans are more closely aligned with corporations, although Democrats are plenty aligned with corporations. But you're not going to see the kind of transformative reforms that introduce real competition into the system unless it's a bottom-up grassroots movement that happens state by state.
Yep. And as you sort of look back on the, you know, 9 years you've been doing this, what's sort of the win that you're most proud of and the most difficult loss?
Gosh, that's a good one. There's a lot to pick from. I'll go with the win that I'm most proud of, which we only get a little credit for. But in Michigan in 2018, there were five anti-gerry. I didn't say this in the presentation, but right now there's seven states that have passed comprehensive anti-gerrymandering reform, all at the ballot. No coincidence. The parties are not very good at doing that themselves in the legislatures. And before 2018, only two had passed anti-gerrymandering laws. And in 2018, five states passed anti-gerrymandering laws: Ohio, Michigan, Colorado, Utah, and one other, Missouri. And in 2017, backing up the clock, a young woman named Katie Fahey called us up from Michigan, and she's like, I did this Facebook post. It's a famous story within our movement. I put up this Facebook post and I said, I want to fix gerrymandering in Michigan. It was right after Trump had won. And is anybody interested in helping? And she had thousands of responses. So she goes to the mainstream public interest groups. She goes to the mainstream politicians and political parties. She starts looking for support and allies in Michigan. And they were all like, bug off. You're a political neophyte. You don't know what you're doing. You're just good at Facebook. And we were the one organization in the country, one major national organization, that were like, this is good. We like this. And we gave her a ton of support and made sure that she could succeed. And then she took the ball and she ran, and they won with 63% of the vote with the strongest anti-gerrymandering law in the country out of those five states. And it was in part because the mainstream groups and parties thought that they were going too far and they needed to reel it in and be more realistic. And we were the ones willing to go the big run with them. The biggest defeat probably was in South Dakota, which was bittersweet. We won a comprehensive campaign finance reform law in South Dakota, one of the most conservative states in America, we passed publicly funded elections in that state by reframing it as an anti-corruption measure and just running a really well-executed campaign. And then the legislature repealed that law about 6 months later. We thought we had gamed the strategy so that wouldn't happen, and it did, and that was gut-wrenching.
So looking at just one area of focus for you guys, we're sort of sitting here in the state of Maine, which is the poster child for ranked choice voting.
Yeah.
So what would you hope that ranked choice voting map looked like 4 or 5 years down the road? Like, what's a sort of realistic expectation for that?
The goal on ranked choice voting would see to at least a dozen states in 4 years. And it's very ambitious, yes, but it's very doable. Right now, we've got campaigns going, ballot initiatives in Massachusetts, Arkansas, North Dakota, and Alaska. It is hard to pass ranked choice voting, but there are some passionate organizers working on it. There's some real money being put into this work by major philanthropists, billionaire philanthropists, putting in significant money because they realize, like the 15,000 people who donate to my organization realize, that this is the issue that has to be changed. And then in 2021, we are going to be working to pass ranked choice voting in state legislatures. Mm. And there is a possibility of doing that in some state legislatures that tend to lead on issues, states like Vermont and other more innovative states, the Washington state, and then more ballot initiatives in 2022 and 2024. But it's going to take a ton of work, a lot of resources, and that's what we're focused on most.
Yeah. You mentioned money, right? So how much do these campaigns cost versus what it costs to elect a congressman or
senator? They're expensive. I mean, compared to the cost of electing congressmen, I don't have the latest number on specific congressional races, but I mean, it's just incredible how much money it costs to run for federal office today. And it dwarfs the numbers that it takes to do this reform. But still, you know, a ballot initiative, say in Massachusetts for ranked choice voting, it's going to cost north of $10 million. So wow. While that's a lot of money, when you consider the ROI in terms of fundamentally transforming politics and being a key step in this kind of like our only hope towards salvaging this democracy, then the cost is relatively low. And as you know, the presidential candidates are churning through orders of magnitude more money than this every week. So, you know, it's all relative, and it's going to be hundreds of millions of dollars ultimately to achieve the map I described by 2024.
So we're all hyper-focused on this upcoming election. I believe it's 95 days away from today. What does it mean for the work if Trump is reelected, and what does it mean if Biden prevails?
Well, you know, it's interesting that the effect it has on our state-centric strategy is so much more limited than the outcome of the election for so many other issues and so many other topics. These state campaigns continue apace, and they will, it's kind of, it's one of the exciting things about it. It's, it doesn't get thrown around by the winds of today's political debate. Realistically, if Trump wins, we see the courts move even farther to the right and to a place where it will result in key decisions related to democracy that will work against the public interest, because the conservative court is definitely making judgments consistently that hurt the public interest on gerrymandering and right to vote. It will incite the donor class and the activist class to dig in even harder with us, because the system dysfunction will be even more acute and obvious. And if Biden wins, there's a real risk. There's a real risk that people say, oh, well, you know, Trump was kind of off the rails, which he is in many ways. But now things are back to normal and everything's okay. I can go back to giving my time and treasure to these issues I care about, like inequality and healthcare and education and poverty, when in fact the system failure will continue unabated in the long term unless we change these laws. So those would be the major differences. There are many others, but those are the biggies.
As you mentioned, I do love those exhibits you put up that show sort of the long time scale and how the progress sort of accumulates and reaches a tipping point for marriage equality or women's suffrage. So across your issues, your areas of focus, what's closest to that yellow line and what's furthest away?
We're pretty far off from the yellow line on most of these. And remember, I mean, this is a really important point, Will. With these other issues, whether it's marriage equality or women's right to vote, you have a pretty binary policy you're after, right? It's like women either have the right to vote or they don't. Mm-hmm. Gay people are either allowed to get married or they're not. They're granted are more nuances in marriage equality policy, right? As you recall, when that was happening, there was a wide debate within the movement as to what they were after. But this has a bunch of different fronts, and I've outlined them. And there are many others that I didn't even include in the presentation, like legitimate efforts to reverse Citizens United and pass a constitutional amendment, which doesn't make it into my Venn diagram because it's a little too far outside of the viable, but very important. I would say the goal is going to be probably on gerrymandering. I think we are going to be the closest because we are seeing the most mainstream support for that reform, and we're seeing the most public understanding of it. If you talk to the average voter and you say, do you know what gerrymandering is? Most of them say yes, which is not the case 10 years ago. Whereas on ranked choice voting or open primaries or automatic voter registration, the answer is no, and we have a lot longer to go there. But people do need to be thinking in increments of 5 years on this policy and this reform effort, not in increments of 1 month or 1 year.
So gerrymandering is maybe closest.
Closest, I'd
say. What's furthest away? What's going to be the longest time frame?
Probably campaign finance. Yep. The good news there, and I love the Q&A format because we can get into this a little bit. Jennifer Lawrence made a point about how when you change election law, it's very powerful because if Maine changes its election law, it can apply to the state house, the attorney general, the governor, and the federal congressional delegation and the election for U.S. president. Campaign finance doesn't have that advantage. The states determine their own campaign finance law for the state legislature and statewide electeds, but it is the federal government that dictates campaign finance laws and ethics laws for federal elected officials. You have a separation which makes the path to victory more difficult. And there were a lot of setbacks in the 90s and the early aughts on campaign finance reform. And that issue is somewhat stuck. The good news is, as I mentioned, that the Democrats have started to embrace campaign finance reform in a more firm way than we've seen since Watergate. And it is conceivable, I'm not holding my breath, but it's conceivable if the Democrats have a trifecta. Obama said just yesterday that he thinks it would be good to end the filibuster in the Senate. It is conceivable you could see a pretty bold campaign finance reform package passed by a Democratic Congress and signed by a Democratic president.
Huh, interesting.
But at the states, it'll still lag.
Yep. So how do the sort of well understood problems with polarization of the news media, Fox News and MSNBC, and manipulation of social media content. So how does that overlap and influence your work?
It's good. I mean, I'm thanks for asking that.
I mean, you must hear that a lot, right?
Yeah, well, and there's a legitimate critique, which is, and I'm going to name it, that there is truth in the fact that, there's some people watching this right now who are saying, no, it's fake news. It's Russia. It's North Korea and these other states, and there's domestic manipulation of U.S. social media that is driving us apart, that is skewing understandings of who candidates are and what issues matter. It's very dramatic and severe in terms of inciting and driving the soft civil war that I mentioned earlier. That is true. But that is not the greatest driver of the problem. The problem is far greater because of the structural, the corruption and lack of integrity brought by bribing, the routine bribing of political parties and political leaders. It's brought by the dynamic I mentioned regarding gerrymandering, the lack of competition, the inability of an independent or a libertarian or a Green Party candidate to even get in a race and try to win because the election system is so fundamentally broken. But the fake news problem, the digital misinformation, and I don't mean the president's version of fake news, which he calls anything that's critical of him fake news. I mean the fake news of news stories that look to be news that actually are created by Russian operatives. That will continue to be a growing problem. And fortunately, there are some efforts underway, really they're quite creative, that are being done to fix the problem. And there are finally some real concrete steps being taken by the major tech companies to address it. Facebook is lagging behind Twitter and other platforms, but that's improving. And then there is the problem of the mainstream press and the sort of Fox News, anything the Republicans do or say is correct, and MSNBC, anything the Democrats do or say is correct, which also is skewing this debate. You can't really do much about that problem. You can't regulate Fox News or MSNBC, but I do find it nauseating when I watch these channels and I see this sort of unchecked support for lack of criticism of the party of their favor. And that is a disservice to the public. And it just requires a sort of a media literacy that doesn't exist, in part because our broken system has resulted in a broken public education system mm-hmm. and hundreds of millions of Americans who are not as good at thinking critically and understanding the world around them because our education system is suffering so much.
So as you sort of look at 2020, you summarize sort of the priorities for the coming election, the initiatives you guys are involved with. Like what's a good outcome there that sort of sets the table for 21 and 22 in the longer game? Like what realistically are you guys hoping to achieve across those?
There's a couple. I think on the voting issue in the short term, it's that we don't have a legitimate challenge by the president or his proxies against the legitimacy of the election, that vote by mail runs relatively smoothly. We have a challenge, Will, in that we are culturally accustomed to the result of the election being known on election night. It's an American tradition. We sit there. I mean, everybody watching this has, if you pay attention to politics at all, which you are because you're watching this, you sit in anticipation, you text and call your loved ones, you talk about the outcome of the election. That is not happening this year. We are about a quarter of Americans voted by mail in 2016, which is actually higher than you might have thought going into this today. I'll bet most people watching are surprised it was that high. It's been going up steadily over the last 10, 15 years. This year, it will be well over 50%. And it will be in systems that are not used to that level of vote by mail participation. Keep in mind, major important swing states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, they have seen single digit vote by mail numbers historically, and they are going to be dramatically higher. It's going to take time. There are going to be some mistakes. There will be some failures with the Postal Service. There will be some fraud, but it will be small. It will be far less than in all likelihood, than the margin of victory based on statistical sort of modeling. But it is going to be an election week in 2020, not an election day. And one thing anyone watching this can do is start passing along that truism, because it's really helpful. Tweet about it, put it on social media, talk to your friends at dinner parties. It's election week in 2020. You will not have the result on election night, and it's okay.
So you wear a lot of hats, Josh, and among them, you're an entrepreneur and a CEO, right? So as you look at Represent Us, what are some of the organizational managerial challenges that sort of face you right now? And what do you hope the organization looks like 5 years down the road?
Well, it's funny. I did not miss the name of the book you wrote in 2012. So I know that there's a Thorndike line of questioning here, a question you've asked a lot. Before I get into it, I will mention I didn't answer your last question fully. We have those ballot initiatives this year on ranked choice voting and anti-gerrymandering, open primaries, campaign finance. We need to win at least half of them. Now, you might say, well, that seems like a low bar, but ballot initiatives are really hard to win. A lot of times when you go into the polling place, you look at the so-called ballot language by which you decide yes or no. And a lot of times it's gobbledygook because a legal technocrat wrote it. But we need to win at least half of those and continue this victory narrative so that we can keep people inspired and keep this theory of change afloat. As far as Represent Us, this will come as no surprise to you. The big challenge is we started almost 9 years ago, just a little group.
Just a word on your funding as you're going through this. I think people would be curious.
And we started, we were under $1 million our first year, well, for our first 3 years. Scrappy little group doing the work. And then we grew by about 20% a year each year. Then we had some big growth. We were a $5 million organization in 2018. We were a $9 million organization last year, and we're tracking to be about a $13 million organization this year. Wow, but still paltry when you consider the task at hand. Now we are one of the two largest democracy reform groups in the country, but that's sad at $13 million. Remember, the big environmental groups, they're between $100 and $160 million a year, and the ACLU.
They've had a bit of a head start.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, and we have to get there. So the bottom line is, one, you go from doing the work to managing people, setting vision, where are we trying to go, and just trying to get the greatest people you can. We have about 45 people now. Mm. And the direction we go is to be a 100-plus person organization with a 100 million-plus budget, because frankly, what I've showed your audience today is a big, audacious vision of how we reclaim American democracy. And you don't do that unless you get to scale. And full transparency, after this presentation, I'm going to ask Will for a bunch of advice on how to be a better CEO, because it takes constant relearning your job, as you can attest.
So that's excellent, Josh. Thank you. So we're going to go now to Q&A. Let's see. So we've got a question here from, looks like, Maria Higgins. Do you think incarcerated people should have the right to vote? If yes, in the district of their incarceration or in the district of their home?
Interesting. First of all, the answer is yes. Incarcerated people, I believe, in many instances should have the right to vote. There is a legitimate argument that the most egregious offenders should not. And I'm not an expert on this topic. And it's funny, I'm not as much of the voting rights ilk in terms of my background as I am about the sort of structure of elections and campaign finance ilk. But the short answer is yes, incarcerated people should be able to vote. I have some sympathy for arguments that the most egregious offenders in society perhaps should not. And I feel very strongly that people who are former felons, who in many states do not have the right to vote, should have the right to vote. You should have the right, if you've served your time, to restart your life. There's a huge story out of Florida where 1.4 million ex-felons were re-enfranchised in 2018 through an amazing ballot initiative. Mm-hmm. And the courts just ruled that a million of them no longer have that right again because they owe some fines to the state. Mm-hmm. We can go to the next one.
Great. Let's see. Hasn't your grassroots local and state victories model been the path of the very successful far right effort? How can you make this model work for us?
It's worked.
Which I mean, by which I believe the viewer means,
the royal
elsewhere
us.
In the royal us, the elsewhere royal in the political us. Spectrum.
Yeah. It's worked for everybody. I mean, I don't know if anybody's going to argue that the marriage equality and marijuana movements were the far right. So the most recent examples of this bottom-up strategy working have indeed been centrist and center-left. So no, I don't believe that to be the case. Certainly term limits, which can't happen federally and moved at the grassroots. Marcy's Law, which is a victim's right law, I don't think it trends that way, and it doesn't matter because what we are doing is ideology free. We have about a third of our members are either center right or hard right conservatives. This is a very unique and liberating issue in that you truly can join hands with people who don't agree with you ideologically, but they do agree that the system's rigged and that the public interest should be foremost in the minds of politicians. And once you really embrace that, it is both liberating, it's empowering, and truly unique in the issue space that is U.S. politics.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, given the multiple goals you laid out, what's the one thing each of us can do beginning right now to help meet these goals? That's from Beth Rendero, and it's a great question.
I owe Beth a drink. Thank you, Beth. You can go to represent.us, and you can sign up. And you can become part of this movement. There, we have spent 9 years optimizing a system so that you can onboard into our organization for free. We prefer if you can also make a contribution, hit the donate button, but I'd be remiss if I don't say that. And we have a variety of volunteer tracks that volunteers can take based on whether you want to do it post-COVID, away from the home, get out in your community, or from home through clicktivism. There's a bunch of different ways to do it. So go to represent.us and you can sign up there. You can also look at votesafe.us. I didn't mention that, where you can learn how to get involved in the immediate election this year through votesafe.us.
Great. Okay, we have a question from our board chair, Phil Moriarty. What role do you see for classrooms at all levels for your reform/fix goals? Is there a role for education?
There absolutely is. And there has been some promising steps taken in the academy towards that end, but mostly at the advanced degree. So University of Chicago is currently launching a very ambitious program around getting universities and colleges more integrated with this work. It's not happening as much at the school level. That is at the high school and grammar school level. That is a program that is to be launched when we have the capacity to do so. We are not big enough. We don't have enough funding yet to do it, but it is important. And it also would be a welcome sort of new player in this space if a group chose to really focus on that. You can email me at silver@represent.us, and I could connect you, Beth, with the people who are behind the University of Chicago effort if you'd like to.
Great. So, Josh, thank you so much for your time. Good luck with your pelvis.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk featured a conversation between Josh Silver, founder and director of Represent Us, a postpartisan organization that passes laws that fix our broken elections, and Will Thorndike, founder and managing director at Housatonic Partners, a leading middle market private equity firm. This presentation was part of the 2020 College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute. This year's theme was November 3rd, What's at Stake? And you can listen to all of this year's presentations online at coa.edu/giving/Champlain Institute. Stay tuned for another Speaking in Maine program featuring a talk from this year's College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute. If you missed part of today's program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.